and it was all very sweet and all very small. Alice could see straight for miles from where she sat, and there wasn't a person in sight until she stood up. She gasped, stepped back. The strangest scene was set before her. Alice couldn't understand why everything was so different so suddenly, but it had been her movements, however small, that disturbed the land of still, and now she stood facing all of its occupants. A sea of citizens had appeared in silent protest. There were ladies, ladies, everywhere. They wore suits, an orange pantsuit here, green over there, purple in one corner, red in another. They were a rainbow of ladies sitting perfectly still on stools and tables and crates and benches, on sidewalks and steps and bicycle seats. Hundreds of them, and they were all, every one of them, staring at her. "Oliver?" Alice could feel him standing beside her, but she was afraid to break eye contact with the ladies.
"Oliver,"
she whispered,
"what do we do?"
He said something so quietly she could hardly hear him.
"What?"
She glanced in his direction. The ladies gasped. Round eyes and round mouths gaped at her.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't—"
More gasps, horrified faces, stunned silence. Alice was starting to grow nervous. Apparently, speaking was not allowed in still. No speaking, no moving, no disruptions at all. This was all an assumption, of course, as Alice didn't know the first thing about still or anything at all in Ray, what she was or wasn't allowed to do here, as Oliver, as usual, appeared to be no help. He hadn't prepared her a stitch for what to expect in still, and if they were eaten alive by a group of angry young ladies. Well, Alice thought, he would have no one to blame but himself. Now, before we get to what Alice did next, allow me, first, the opportunity to defend her actions. In retrospect, I realize her decision wasn't very constructive, but she wasn't going to stand still for all of eternity. After all, she had Father to think of. So I will say this. In my opinion, her decision was, at least in the moment, a realistic one. She took a few steps forward. Someone screamed. Something shattered. Alice knew immediately that she'd made a mistake, but in her haste to correct the error, she made a few more. She scrambled backward, trying to undo what she'd done, but the more she moved, the more it disturbed the ladies of still, and soon they were shrieking, all of them screaming and howling and pulling at their hair, their clothes. They raked their fingers down their faces and drew blood, shed tears, and lost themselves in crazed, choking sobs. Alice felt like crying, too, but for very different reasons. The ladies had begun to stand now, but slowly. Their eyes, openly weeping, never left Alice's face, and the sight of it all was so monstrous that Alice's poor heart nearly quit. The ladies' movements were so careful, so slow and methodical, that it was all somehow worse. It would be a slow death, Alice thought, a careful torture, an agony she could not scream through. Terror had so thoroughly overtaken her she was afraid to breathe.
"Alice, run!"
Oliver grabbed her hand, and they charged through still, destroying every bit of composure the village had carefully preserved. They tore through leaves that then crashed to the ground. They whipped through raindrops that broke on their faces and splashed down their necks. They plowed through snowflakes that caught in their hair and clung to their clothes. The ladies sprang after them.
"Faster!" yelled Oliver. "We must go faster!"
And though Alice wanted to kick him in the feet and tell him she was running as fast as she possibly could, she was also in the unfortunate position of being unable to breathe, and so decided to save her quips for a better time. She pushed herself, one small leg after another, to climb up the very high hill that led to the only street that ran through still, and tried very hard not to focus on the fact that they were probably going to die. Admittedly, she was not very good at this. The ladies of still were close behind. They were screeching in pain, no doubt agonized by all this exercise that had been forced upon them, and Alice was crying, albeit only a little, but mostly because she was so desperately tired and because she thought she should very definitely stop running lest her lungs should shatter. But no matter, the ladies of Still did not give a fig about Alice's lungs, and so her legs and lungs would have to soldier through, whatever the cost. Oliver's hand was wrapped tightly around hers, and he was nearly dragging her up the main street now. Alice had no idea how he was managing all this and still carrying the pocketbook, but she was in no position to ask or even offer any help, as she realized rather quickly that the black stone with which this road was paved was in fact quite slippery, and she was already doing all she could to stay upright. They skidded as they ran, slipping and stumbling and holding on to each other for dear life. The ladies were now silent as snow, catching up to them even without their realizing it, and Alice turned back just in time to catch a glimpse. They were running on tiptoe, knees up and knocking into their chests, and they looked so ridiculous Alice was almost ready to laugh. In agony, ridiculous though they may have looked, at least they knew what they were doing. These ladies had mastered the road, while Alice and Oliver only struggled to survive it. The two children staggered and slipped, constantly readjusting, never fully regaining their footing. All seemed lost. Alice's legs felt as though they were melting beneath her, and if Oliver ever said a word to her, she could not hear him. Her breaths, hard and rasping, were all she knew, and the pounding in her chest had spread up to her head and down her arms, and she was so blinded by pain that she could hardly see. She wanted to give up. She nearly did. Instead, Alice shook her head and forced herself to focus. Quitting would be easy. Dying would be simple, but neither would solve her problems, and both would leave Father lost forever. She had to find a way to keep the two of them alive. Well, and Oliver, too. Suddenly she had an idea. All this running they'd done, all this energy they'd exerted, it could be put to good use, couldn't it? There was no time to deliberate. She grabbed Oliver's shirt, kicked him in the backs of his knees, and knocked the both of them onto their backs. Before Oliver had even a chance to shout about it, they were flying, sliding, gliding. They were practically penguins sloping down the shiny street, moving so quickly you'd think they had wings. Up and left and down and right, the street curved and swayed and dipped and flipped, and with it they went human roller coasters, ready to be sick upon stopping. Eventually the road came to an end, and with it Alice's only hope for escape. She and Oliver had been dumped at the outer edge of Still, beyond which was nothing but grass for miles on end. There was no way out, it seemed, and certainly no time to celebrate Alice's temporary stroke of genius. In the few moments they wasted catching their breaths, the ladies of Still had spent catching up to their bodies. Hundreds of ladies in colorful suits and angry, bloodied faces were waiting to attack. Two dizzy, dazed, and broken children. They had nothing left to spare, not an ounce of energy, not a shred of power. "Not a single
Alice,"
Oliver gasped.
"Oh, Alice, bless you," he said. "Bless you for getting us to the other side, you wonderful girl."
And he tugged a stoppick out of his bag, broke it in half with his teeth, turned back for only a moment, and threw it hard in the direction of their attackers. Everything slowed. The broken casings spun with no real speed, but the very presence of magic sent the ladies into a wild-eyed frenzy. They were salivating, faces distorted by tortured excitement as the magic drew closer, but their eagerness turned to anger as the remains of the stoppick froze and shattered in midair. The ladies shrieked and shrank back, clawing at their eyes as tens of thousands of colorful threads fell from the sky and wove themselves across the land, creating a beautiful and terrifying barricade. Alice couldn't believe something so simple had worked. She also wondered where Oliver had gotten so much magic and how much more he had left. Oliver collapsed.
"Alice," he said. "Oh, Alice, you were excellent. That could have gone so badly," he said. "But you did so well."
"That could have gone badly?" Alice was staring at him in shock, even as she crumpled to the ground. "You mean it could have gone worse than them nearly killing us? Oliver, have you gone mental?" Oliver shook his head. He was on his hands and knees trying to breathe.
"You have no idea how much worse it could have been," he said. "The first time I met the ladies of Still," he laughed, wheezed, "I tried to be charming."
"Oh, Oliver," Alice said, cringing.
"You didn't."
She coughed twice and prayed for her legs to stop cramping.
"I did," he said, sitting up. His breathing was a little better now, still broken, but evening out. "And it was a most thorough rejection. I did my best, but it proved impossible to persuade such a large number of ladies to believe anything I said."
"So how did you get through?"
she asked, as she, too, pushed herself up into a more comfortable position.
"Well, the first time I only broke free by accident. I was very nearly done for. They'd had me stripped down to my underpants and climb into a pot over the fire."
Alice gasped and covered her mouth with both hands,
"because it had been a long time since they'd had any dinner, you see."
"They were really going to eat you,"
she cried, dropping her hands.
"I still can't believe—"
"Yes," Oliver said, "but," he held up one finger, "while they were busy trying to light the fire, one of the ladies tripped over my clothes and stepped on a few stoppics that had tumbled out, accidentally releasing their magic."
He waved his hand with a flourish.
"They went mad. They were thrilled. All they want is magic, after all. It's the central reason they want to eat us. But I hardly had time to be relieved before they were demanding more. More magic. Everything I had, they took me for every fink they could find, and it still wasn't enough. So they were going to eat me anyway."
Alice was shaking her head in horror.
"Luckily, all their procrastination gave me time to form a better plan. I had one last stoppick tucked behind my ear, and I decided to put it to good use. I was outnumbered and would have been completely useless in any kind of battle, and as I had only a single stoppick, which isn't enough magic to do much damage, I had to think quickly. A temporary barrier seemed like just the thing to help me get away."
Oliver nodded at the woven wall he'd built.
"This will fade eventually, but it'll keep for at least several hours or so," he laughed. "Good grief! Getting in and out of Still has proven a highly expensive endeavor, hasn't it? Though I do hope I can say with some confidence that our lives were worth it," he said, still laughing.
Oliver was thrilled, grinning from cheek to cheek, feeling far too triumphant to notice the careful narrowing of Alice's eyes. Using magic to solve a problem felt like cheating. After all, not everyone had spare stoppics just lying around, and it made Alice angry, now that she thought about it, to know that she'd need more than just courage to survive, and furthermore, she pressed her lips together. Alice had been considering Oliver's finks and stoppics for some time now, often wondering at his casual use of magic and his practiced skills in conjuring and manipulation. These were skills Alice never had access to, and not for a lack of wanting. She had, of course, taken basic classes on the harnessing and transformation of contained magic, but that was all theory. She'd never interacted with much raw magic, and when she did have a few finks in her pocket, they were very precious to her. She used them carefully and thoughtfully. Alice had never known anyone who could throw money around the way Oliver had in the last few hours, and she couldn't imagine what that kind of luxury was like. Thinking about money made Alice unspeakably sad. She still had much to learn in life, but she'd seen enough to know that money mattered, and though she didn't understand the whole of it, she did understand that a few extra stoppics in a pocket often made it easier to live. 1,000 times Alice had wondered whether having money would have helped her find father sooner, and thinking about it now put a pinch in her heart. Alice bit her lip as she looked Oliver over, taking care to really notice him now. She squinted at the simple clothes he wore, the ones she'd so carelessly dismissed earlier, and this time noted the careful stitching, the heavy fabric, and the expertly tailored fit. She noticed his hands, smooth and unblemished, his nails clean and short and buffed. Her eyes roved over his shiny hair, his glowing brown skin, the healthy brightness in his blue-violet eyes. Alice was beginning to realize something about Oliver that she'd never realized before.
"Oliver,"
she said quietly.
Are you very rich?
Oliver blinked fast. What?
Do you have a great deal of money?
She asked, valiantly ignoring the heat blooming in her cheeks.
A great deal?
He said, eyes wide and surprised.
No,
he said.
I don't think so, not any more than most people, I imagine.
Alice bit the inside of her cheek and swallowed back all the things she nearly said.
Much more than me,
she nearly said.
I've never touched a stomach in all my life,
she nearly said.
Oh,
was what she actually said. Oliver wore a pained expression, his cheeks warmed by a truth neither one of them wished to acknowledge, and Alice was surprised to find that his discomfort bothered her, embarrassed her even. So she changed the subject.
The town of Still seems so small compared to Slumber,
she said, staring at the colorful barricade Oliver had built.
Where are we now? Why isn't anyone trying to eat us anymore?
Right! Yes!
Oliver said too loudly, relieved to be discussing something new.
Well, the villages in Furthermore are all built differently.
He nodded.
Some are big, some are small, some are very, very tall, but Still isn't a proper village, and it's not meant to be. Still is only home to one person.
One person? Said Alice. But what about all the ladies who just tried to eat us?
Ah, well, the ladies of Still are just a security measure,
Oliver explained. They're here to protect the land from unwanted visitors, but the person we're here to meet has no interest in eating anyone. In fact, he's one of my few good friends in Furthermore.
Who is he?
She asked.
Who are we here to meet?
Oliver met her gaze, the moon glinting behind him.
Time.
Alice sat there a moment longer, waiting for Oliver to tell her he was joking, when he tugged on her braid and said,
"Narrow-mindedness, Alice, will do us no good."
Alice scowled and slapped his hand away from her hair.
"I'm not narrow-minded,"
she said.
"It's just difficult for me to believe that we are actually about to meet time."
She nearly rolled her eyes. Oliver gasped, and very loudly. His eyes were wide and horrified, and he dropped his voice to a whisper.
"Listen closely," he said. "Do not let those words leave your lips again. You do not disbelieve in Furthermore. Do it enough times and you'll end up there."
"End up where?"
"In disbelief," he said, and shuddered.
"It's a horrid town."
Alice was afraid to ask him why, so she only nodded and said nothing more, keeping her disbelief to herself. After their lungs had rested a while, they walked on tired legs into the still night, where birds were free to sing and crickets were free to dance and frogs would happily croak. They walked through grass that grew up to their knees and ponds that kicked quietly at their shores. Oliver stomped on and smiled at nothing in particular, while Alice distracted herself by peeking into the dark woods that crept just beyond, wondering all the while where everyone had gone, or if anyone had ever been, and what time would look like, and would time be nice, and what would happen if time grew old? What would they do if time died? And then she had a thought that wasn't relevant at all, because she was reminded in a quiet moment that she'd been hungry. Very hungry, not too long ago.
Strange.
She didn't feel it at all anymore. She mentioned this to Oliver.
"That's not strange," he said. "Eventually you'll stop being hungry ever again."
"Really?"
she asked him.
"But why?"
"Because the longer you stay in Furthermore, the farther you get from Farrenwood."
"I don't understand,"
she said. Oliver hesitated, tilted his head. "Back home in Farrenwood," he explained, "we have to sleep every night and eat frequently throughout the day, don't we?"
Alice nodded.
"Right, so life without those two things," he said, "would be impossible."
"But not in Furthermore?"
Oliver shook his head. "In Furthermore, you sleep for the dream and eat for the taste." Alice hesitated, considering his words.
"So when they eat people," she said, "they do it only for the taste?"
Oliver was so caught off guard by her question that he laughed and coughed at the same time.
"Well, no," he said. "Not exactly. I have heard that humans have a very particular taste, and that the magical ones give the meals an extra kick."
Alice shuddered at the thought.
"But,"
Oliver said, holding a finger up in the air, "they eat people because their souls are empty, not their stomachs. Here, hunger and exhaustion don't exist the way they do back home. The infrastructure, furthermore, was built with so much magic as to make the very air we breathe work differently. It makes it so food and sleep are no longer a necessity, but a luxury. It was an irreversible decadence that magically bankrupted the land. Now people can indulge in dinners and dreams only in the pursuit of pleasure, because doing so for any other reason," he said simply, "is considered a waste of
time,"
she finished for him. Oliver stopped walking and looked at her. He nodded slowly.
"Yes,"
he smiled just a little. "You seem to be catching on."
"You think so?"
she said.
"I don't think so."
"No?"
"No,"
Alice said.
"I don't think I'm catching on at all. I haven't the faintest idea why we need to meet time, not a clue what it has to do with the pocketbook, and not the tiniest inkling what any of this has to do with finding Father."
She sighed.
"Oliver,"
she said,
"I have never been more confused in all my life."
Oliver looked worried for only a moment before his worries danced away. He laughed, which made him look lovely, and then he charged ahead, whistling a tune she could not place. Finally, they stood in front of a door attached to no house. This seemed to be commonplace in Furthermore, and Oliver was looking nervous. Alice couldn't understand why. It was just a door, after all, and very similar to the one they had encountered at border control, though this one was even bigger, and much taller, and bright red and shiny as an apple, with a fancy handle made of gold. It was a beautiful door, but its secrets must have been contained somewhere she could not see, because on the other side of the door was nothing but trees. She took a moment to inspect it.
"Alice, where on earth are you going?"
Oliver said.
"I just want to look around,"
she said.
"It's only right that I have a chance to see what we're getting ourselves into, isn't it?"
Oliver threw his hands up in defeat, and then he leaned against the door frame, crossed his arms, and nodded, as if to say,
"Please, by all means, take a good look."
So she did. They were right at the edge of the woods now, and surrounded on every side by very, very tall trees whose densely packed, triangle-shaped leaves were a shade of green so dark she had to squint to see their silhouettes. But when she tiptoed farther into the forest, Oliver panicked.
"Not in there,"
he said, pleading.
"Not Alice."
"Why?" She glanced back. The look on his face, really.
"What's the matter?"
"Not in the forest," he said quietly.
"Please, Alice."
"No, very well." Alice relented and tried not to roll her eyes, thinking of how gracious, how patient and tolerant she was of Oliver's whining, and turned to leave. But then,
well, it was strange.
She couldn't move. She didn't want to alarm Oliver, so she didn't say a word, and anyway, she was sure she'd just gotten her skirts caught on a branch or some such. It certainly felt that way. Maybe if she tugged a little harder?
No, that wasn't working either.
She tried again. Finally, she cleared her throat.
"Oliver,"
she said loudly,
"I appear to be stuck."
"What do you mean?"
Oliver was in front of her in an instant, paler than a wax moon, but careful to maintain his distance.
"Oh, it's nothing to worry about,"
she assured him.
"Really?"
She tried to smile.
"It's just that,"
she tried tugging,
"I can't seem to,"
she tugged again,
"get free,"
she sighed.
"Will you see if my skirts are caught on something?"
Oliver went even paler. He was such a little turtle sometimes, his neck disappearing into his chest.
"I told you not to go in the forest,"
was all he managed to whisper.
"Oliver, please,"
Alice said, irritated now.
Don't be such a—
There was no time to finish that sentence, I'm afraid. No time at all. Nope, because Alice was suddenly screaming. It was all fairly embarrassing, actually, because the ordeal was over and done with in only a moment. Alice fell to the ground at Oliver's feet and righted herself in a hurry, dusting off her skirts and whipping around too quickly, trying to get a look at her assailant. But Oliver's face froze her still. He was staring at something with a look of shock she could not have anticipated. She thought nothing, and furthermore could surprise him. She thought he'd seen it all. Apparently not. This was a fox. An origami fox. A sheet of rust and white paper folded expertly into a real, live, deceptively lovely animal. It scampered about and made little fox noises and yipped and jumped and chased itself, and when it trotted along toward Alice, she wasn't afraid at all. Oliver had nearly climbed a tree in fright, but Alice stepped forward, hand outstretched, ready to pet the paper fox. It bounded forward and nuzzled her hand before plowing into her legs, and she laughed and laughed and touched the top of its head, awed by the coarse paper of its fur.
"What's your name?"
she whispered, crouching down to greet him, or her. She didn't know.
"Are you a boy or a girl?"
The fox jumped around her and bit her skirts, tugging on her clothes. For a fox with no teeth, it had quite a bite. Still, she felt no danger. Her new fox friend held her in place until finally she pet its head again.
"Will you let me go?"
she asked. Slowly it nodded, stepped back, and fell into a bow.
"You understand me?"
she asked, astounded. Again the fox nodded.
"Alice,"
said Oliver, his voice high and shaky. He was rifling through his bag with great urgency.
"Could we please get going?"
"Do you know anything about paper foxes?" she asked him. "Have you ever seen one before?" Oliver looked up, startled, his maps clutched in one hand, his notebook in the other, and shook his head. "Furthermore is made up of hundreds of villages," he explained, now flipping through the pages of his notebook, "and I've only been to 68 of them." He paused, scanned a few pages, gave a disappointed sigh, and stuffed the notebook back in his bag. Alice was surprised to see Oliver so anxious. "I haven't any idea where this fox came from," Oliver continued. "But he's not from here, and your father... Well, your father never mentioned a paper fox in his entries, so this can't possibly be good. No, this can't possibly—"
"His entries?"
Alice said, surprised.
"You mean that notebook belonged to father?"
But Oliver wasn't listening. He had unrolled a few map scrolls and was reading them upside down and then right side up, collapsing paper staircases and poking open miniature doors and unlocking tiny windows and finding nothing behind them. He even gave the maps a good shake to see if anything new would fall out, all to no avail. He was looking increasingly worried, which Alice, bless her heart, found highly entertaining.
"It's not right,"
Oliver was saying, jabbing at different parts of the map with one finger.
"It's not as it should be. There's nothing here about a fox."
He shook his head, hard, and rolled up the scrolls he'd so hastily unfurled.
"Oliver,"
Alice tried again,
"is that father's journal you've got there?"
Oliver's jaw twitched.
"What?
This?"
"Oh,"
he said. "Yes, well, it was all part of my task, you know, to help him."
"May I see it?"
Alice asked, stepping forward.
"Please? I'd dearly love to see what father wrote down."
Oliver was clinging to his messenger bag so tightly he was nearly vibrating in place. "I'm afraid that's not possible," he said. "The elders put very firm magical restrictions on the items I've been loaned for my journey, and if they're handled by anyone but me, they'll know."
"Oh,"
said Alice, crestfallen. She knew how tasks worked, and she could imagine the elders having done such a thing. But more importantly, Alice was still operating under the assumption that she could trust Oliver. She thought she'd be able to tell when he was spinning a lie. So she believed him. Oliver was visibly relieved, but Alice, who was once again distracted by the paper fox, didn't seem to notice. Oliver cleared his throat.
We should really get going."
"But he looks so sweet,"
she said.
Can't we bring him along?
Alice had little to hold on to in this strange land, and she was proud to have discovered something Oliver had not. She wanted to contribute something important to their journey and couldn't bring herself to give up on the fox just yet. But Oliver was shaking his head.
"Don't be fooled by furthermore," he said as he shoved the maps back into his bag. "Please, Alice, remember why we're here. If we don't stick to my original plan, we might never reach your father."
Any reminder of father was enough to set Alice's spine straight.
"Of course I remember why we're here," she said quickly, cheeks aflame. "No need to remind me."
Oliver nodded and even looked a little sorry to have said anything.
"No distractions," Alice scolded herself. "No distractions. Think of father," she thought, "waiting for help, hurting somewhere."
That was all it took. She offered a small smile to the fox, who then scampered back into the forest and joined Oliver at the red door. They were here to meet time. They were here to save father. She took a deep breath.
"Are you ready?"
Oliver asked her.
"Always," she said.
And they knocked. The two of them together, her knuckles and his. Oliver said these were important manners, and furthermore, when two people came to visit, both people should knock.
"Otherwise," he said, "it would feel like a lie, wouldn't it?"
He smiled,
thinking only one person was coming over for tea when actually it was two.
Alice raised an eyebrow. She didn't say it then, but she was thinking it.
Oliver was growing odder by the moment.
So they knocked on Time's door until Oliver said they'd knocked enough, and then it was time to wait.
"How long?"
Alice asked.
"How long do we wait?"
"As long as it takes," he said. "We wait until time comes."
10 minutes later, Alice was grumpy. She thought this was all a bit ridiculous, waiting for time. Oh, she was losing her mind, she was sure of it. She tried to remember the last time she'd slept and couldn't. What day was it? How long had they been gone? Had Mother and her brothers finally noticed she'd left? Alice was paid such unaffectionate attention at home that it was hard for her to believe Mother would miss her. But Alice underestimated the space she took up in the hearts and minds of those she met, and she had no way of knowing how her absence would affect the ones she loved. Nor did she have time to dwell on it. Her days were dizzier than ever here in Furthermore, and though she missed her home, she didn't miss the long, empty hours or the interminable stretches of loneliness. Here, at least, she had Oliver, a friend unlike any she'd ever had, and constant adventure to fill her mind. Speaking of which, the big red door had finally opened.
Behind it was a little boy. He wore denim overalls over a bright red T-shirt, and he peered up at them through a pair of spectacles far too large for his face, taking care to stare at Alice the longest. She and Oliver said nothing.
"Good,"
the boy finally said with a sigh.
He sounded like he'd lived the life of an old man. "Very good that you've brought her."
And then he turned around and left, walking back through a door into a world she couldn't see the end of. Oliver moved to follow him, and Alice shot him an anxious look.
"Don't worry,"
Oliver said, reaching for her hand.
"He's my friend, and I've been here before."
They followed the boy through a house so dark Alice almost thought she'd gone blind. In fact, it was so impossible to see anything but the boy that the darkness actually seemed intentional. Time was private, apparently. They three tiptoed through hallways and up stairways and under doorways until finally they reached a room that was brightly lit. Inside was a very old desk and very old chairs. You'll find that young people are very good at spotting old things, and every inch of the room was covered in numbers, plastered to the walls and tables, framed and hung as photos, upholstered to the chairs. Books and books of numbers were piled on floors and windowsills and coffee tables. It was bizarre. The little boy asked them to sit down, and then, to Alice's surprise, took his seat behind the large desk, laced his fingers on the table, and said,
"Alice, it's a pleasure to finally meet you."
"Oh," she said, startled. "It's a pleasure to meet you, too, Mr. Time."
"No need to be so formal," he said, leaning back in his chair. "Call me Tim, and please,"
he smiled and gestured to his appearance,
"forgive my age," he said. "It changes on the hour."
Alice tried to smile.
"Thank you for meeting me here again," he said to Oliver. "I know how much trouble it is to negotiate with my security team, but I can only ever be of use to you when I can stand to be still."
To Alice, he said,
"I hope my friends didn't frighten you too much. Some people find those pantsuits extremely intimidating."
"Not at all,"
she said shakily.
"I thought their pantsuits were lovely."
But Alice was distracted. Tim was dark-haired and olive-skinned in a way that reminded her of father. Father's skin was not such a lovely brown as mother's, but just a shade or two lighter, and Alice's heart was hit with a sudden swell of emotion as she remembered her parents' faces.
"Now then," Tim said as he turned to Oliver, all business, "you brought the book?"
Oliver nodded and placed the pocketbook on the table.
"Very well, very well," said Tim, looking vaguely disappointed. "Thank you for returning it."
Alice glanced at Oliver, all question marks. He still hadn't told her anything about what they were doing here, and she was beginning to realize he seldom did. Not until it was too late. Tim seemed to understand.
"Oliver paid me a visit," he explained. "The last time he was in, furthermore, I'd respectfully requested that, in the very likely chance he should fail in his mission, he returned the pocketbook to me. And now he's here, true to his word."
Tim folded his hands on his desk and took a moment to smile at Oliver in a kind, fatherly fashion which, truth be told, was uncomfortable to witness, as Tim had the face and build of a 7-year-old and appeared to be in no position to have fathered anyone.
"But why was Oliver here before?" Alice asked. "What did he need the pocketbook for?"
"Well," Tim said, surprised, "to find your father's pocket, of course."
"My father's... I'm sorry," she said, stunned. "My father's pocket is in there?"
"Yes," Oliver said quickly. "The pocketbook brought me to Tim the last time I was here. I needed to hand over to him the contents of your father's pocket."
"Oliver!"
Alice gasped, horrified.
"You just handed over father's things to someone else? How could you?"
Oliver sat up in his seat. "No," he said. "It wasn't... I didn't..."
"Your father got himself into a bit of a bind," Tim said gently. "Oliver was only trying to help mend the matter."
"What?"
Alice looked at Oliver, panicked.
"Why didn't you tell me this sooner?"
she cried.
"What did Father do? Was it awful? Did he eat someone?"
Tim flinched at that last bit, but we won't dwell on it. "Of course not," said Oliver. "But he took far too much time to make a decision. Remember, Alice, we talked about this. It's a grave offense." Alice was stunned. It took her a full minute to find her voice, and when she did, she said,
"That is one of the most ridiculous rules I've ever heard in all my life."
Tim cleared his throat, visibly offended, studied a chipped corner of his desk, and pinched his bottom lip between two fingers. Finally, he dropped his fingers and, affecting a tone of sympathy, said,
"See, it's quite simple, really. In furthermore, we do not waste time. Share time or spare time. And I'm afraid your father took more than his measure. Because what he took belonged to me, I was the only one with permission to search his pockets."
He paused.
"Though I'm afraid there wasn't much to reclaim. I had no choice but to repossess his ruler."
Alice's hands fell into her lap as she sat straight up and stared, unblinking, at Tim's round, ticking face. His mouth twitched.
His hands twitched. He looked like an old clock. Suddenly, Alice understood. Is that what Ted meant? She said slowly. About being arrested? She looked from Tim to Oliver. Was Father arrested for taking too much time? Tim's eyebrows hiked up an inch, and his oversized glasses slipped down his nose. Yes, I'd say so, he said, pushing the glasses back into place. I'd say so, yes. Oh, my. Alice had taken to flapping her hands around as the seriousness of it all finally set in. Oh, oh, oh. I know this isn't much in the way of comfort, Oliver said gently, but would you like to see his pocket? Alice dropped her flapping hands and nodded. Oliver checked to make sure it was all right with Tim, and Tim tilted his head approvingly. Oliver gave Alice a warm smile, cracked open the pocketbook, and Alice was on her feet and looking over Oliver's shoulder in the same second it took Tim to sneeze. The old, musty pages of the pocketbook had unleashed a foot of dust into the air, and while Tim used up the moment to blow his boyish nose, Oliver bent over the book with great care. The spine creaked and wheezed like an ancient staircase mounted by mighty beasts, and though Oliver did his best to be gentle, he couldn't help but disturb the peace of the pocketbook. Alice was no help either. She was so amazed, so very enchanted, she reached out and touched it. Jabbed it, really. She pressed a firm finger against a page, and Oliver jolted in his seat, dropping the book in horror. Tim shook his head, sighed, and sneezed twice more into his handkerchief. But worst of all, the book actually yelled at her. Oliver snatched the book off the floor, shooting Alice an admonishing look as he moved it out of her reach, and though he tried to turn the affronted page was refusing to turn. "Oh, be good," Tim finally said, waving his handkerchief at the pocket. "No need to throw a fit," he said. "She was only curious." "I didn't realize a pocket could be angry," Alice said. "These pockets belong to actual people," Oliver explained. "Some of them are attached to the clothes they're still wearing. I believe the woman you just poked was sleeping," Oliver said, fighting back a smile. But his search for Father's pocket was taking a lot longer than Alice had expected, and it was making her anxious. "Is Father's pocket attached to him, too?" she asked, hoping no one could hear the desperation in her voice. Oliver shook his head. Her heart sank. "Pockets," Tim explained, "are usually catalogued only after they've been lost, abandoned. Sometimes a person will want to index the contents of an important pocket they're still wearing, but most others prefer privacy. A pocketbook is often the best place to search for things we've misplaced." Tim clapped a hand on Oliver's shoulder and smiled at Alice. "Very clever of your friend to go looking for it, don't you think?" Alice didn't know what to say. Oliver, seeing the blank look on her face, did his best to explain. "We have pocketbooks in Fernwood, too," he said, "and when I arrived in Furthermore, my first order of business was to try and find one, because I hoped your father's lost belongings had been catalogued." Clever indeed, Alice thought, but she daren't say it aloud. She didn't want to admit this, but she was beginning to resent Oliver's depth of knowledge and experience in Furthermore. She, too, wanted to be smart. She wanted to save the day. It was her father, after all. Where were all her good ideas? Why wasn't she the hero of this story? "As all pockets are cross-referenced with the date, time, and location of discovery," Oliver was saying, "I knew that even if I couldn't access the contents of your father's pocket, I would at least know where he'd lost it, where he'd been. A little luck and a lot of persuasion helped a great deal in my quest. Ultimately, my discovery led me to Tim, who became a great friend. He's taught me so much about Furthermore." Again, Tim looked on like a proud parent. Alice felt herself go numb, feeling more useless by the moment. "Oh," was all she said. Oliver turned another page in the book, and then finally, ah, here we are. He tapped, gently, very gently, the open page, and the book groaned, but quietly this time.
This is it, Oliver said.
This is the one.
And there it was. Father's pocket. Alice recognized it instantly. It was the only pocket on his faded denim jacket. She remembered this because he was wearing it the last time she'd seen him, nearly 3 years ago.
Oliver,
she whispered, her two eyes on the book and two hands clasped in her lap.
Please tell me what's going on. What happened to Father after he was arrested? Did he manage to get free? Is he hiding somewhere?
Tim looked to Oliver. Oliver looked away. Alice bit her lip. Emotion had drenched her heart, and she was running out of ways to wring it dry.
What is it? What's the problem?
My dear girl, Tim said gravely, your father is in prison.
Alice heard her breath hitch.
And his sentence is very long, said Oliver.
Oh, yes, said Tim. It was made up of many words.
Alice turned to Oliver, her eyes filling fast.
So when you said you knew where Father was, this was what you meant? You knew he'd been imprisoned?
Oliver nodded.
The last time I was here, he said, I tried to get him out the proper way. I thought if I followed the rules, I'd be able to get him released.
He shook his head.
But now I know that the only way to get him out is to break him free.
Alice sniffed away her tears and tried to be brave.
So we have to do something illegal?
Oliver nodded again.
Well,
said Alice, pulling herself together.
Go on, then.
She looked from Oliver to Tim.
What is it? What do we have to do?
Neither of them had a quick answer. Tim finally leaned forward, studied the two children before him, and said,
Oliver, have you never told Alice what you need her for? Does she not know why she's here? Of course I know why I'm here, said Alice, interjecting. I'm here to help find my father.
Tim raised an eyebrow.
I'm certain you are, he said. But did you not ask why Oliver needed your help? Your help, specifically?
Well, yes, I did, but...
Alice stopped short to glance at Oliver, whose face had turned a fine shade of tomato.
Well,
she said hastily,
Oliver said that it was Father who asked for me. It was Father who told Oliver to find me. I'm not sure why Father asked for me exactly,
she admitted, wringing her hands.
But it doesn't matter, does it? Father wants me here. Father asked for my help.
Tim removed his glasses and sighed. Alice looked from him to Oliver and back again, growing more anxious by the moment.
Oliver,
said Tim, disappointment heavy in his voice.
I didn't expect such scheming from you. You should have been honest with her about your hopes and expectations on this journey.
What hopes?
Said Alice, turning frantically to Oliver.
What expectations? What's going on?
Oliver had turned maroon. He refused to make eye contact with Alice, no matter how hard she looked at him, and Alice was suddenly accosted by terror. She felt a fist of panic clench around her throat, and, despite her efforts to shout angry things at Oliver, she struggled to speak.
Alice, dear,
Tim said to her as he replaced the glasses on his face,
Oliver has never met with your father. He's never spoken a word to him.
Alice nearly fell out of her chair.
But he said,
I'm afraid he lied to you.
No,
Alice gasped, looking desperately at Oliver.
That's not possible. You see, I made an ever-binding promise.
Tim was shaking his head.
Oliver has never seen your father, at least not in furthermore, he said firmly. He's never made it that far.
Alice, poor thing, was beginning to hyperventilate.
Breaking your father out of prison is a fine idea,
Tim went on. But the problem is, no one knows exactly where the prisons are located. There are dozens and dozens of them, each an entire village unto itself, and all secured by intensely private entrances. They're meant to be nearly impossible to access. Don't you see? It's not as simple as... Alice? Alice?
Alice's mind was spinning.
Oliver had lied to her, which meant Oliver had been lying to her. But for how long? How many lies had he told? And how had he managed to trick her? And how could she ever trust him now? How would she ever...
Tim rapped the desk to get her attention.
Young lady, Tim said sharply, are you listening at all? I said I need to see your visitor pamphlets. I do hope you have your visitor pamphlets, he said with a frown. You should have received them at border control. You did go through border control, didn't you? It would make matters infinitely worse if you were here without a ruler.
No,
Alice managed to say.
I mean, yes. Yes, I have my ruler, and the pamphlets.
She dug through her pockets, unearthed a stack of glossy brochures, and pushed them across the desk. She was dizzy with fear and couldn't bring herself to look at Oliver anymore. Tim adjusted his glasses and picked up the first and thinnest of the bunch, which was titled, What to Know Before You Go, A Quick and Easy Guide to Furthermore. When Tim opened the slim pamphlet, it unfolded itself across the desk and onto the floor until it grew to be no shorter than 10 feet in length, every inch of which was covered in cramped, spasmodically capital-lettered print, and was more than occasionally punctuated by overzealous exclamation points. Alice found the entire business overwhelming, and was silently grateful she hadn't bothered to peruse the other pamphlets. Furthermore, phrasebook. How to understand the languages you don't speak. Destination guide. The top 10 villages you should visit this year. And shop like a local. Insider secrets to the best gifts in town. Because it all looked like information for tourists, and Alice didn't consider herself a tourist. She considered herself the brave heroine of an unlikely tale.
Ah, said Tim, tapping a bit of text on the page. Here, do you see? Under the permitted and prohibited items list. It's been recently updated, you know.
He glanced at Alice and scooted closer, making room so she could get a better look. Time is permitted until it is prohibited, that is, until it has expired, which is to say, until it is no longer valid under the terms and conditions it was originally acquired, said terms and conditions having been agreed to upon the receipt of one, furthermore, standard issue ruler, the procurement of which is required for all visitors as of 60 and 2 years hence, see section 172-5.42, and as such, the illegal acquisition of time shall be punishable by the law of all lands, and the punishment shall be no fewer than 5 years enslaved imprisonment in isolation, hereafter referred to as EII, a sentence bound by the laws of exile, the duration of which may vary. Amended to add, in an effort to emphasize the severity of time thievery, EII shall be henceforth effectuated by the laws of complex color.
Alice sat back and collapsed in her chair.
She was sure her bones had come loose. In fact, for a moment she thought she could hear them, elbows knocking against wrists, cracking against knuckles. But it wasn't that at all. It was Tim. Tim, who was rapping the desk again, trying to get her attention. Alice jerked in her seat.
Alice! Alice! Tim was saying. Do you understand what you've just read?
I do.
Alice's voice was steady, but she couldn't make herself look at Tim.
Father has been enslaved for wasting time.
Yes, my dear, but it's more complicated than that. Furthermore, has been reinforcing all prison sentences with the law of complex color.
Alice blinked. Tim leaned in.
Do you know what that is?
Alice glanced at Oliver one final awful time in an effort to make him speak, but Oliver was determined to look at the floor. The coward, she thought. It made her hate him to know that he'd known all this and never told her. She'd thought they'd moved past these obstacles. She'd thought they were equals now, that he would have shared all truths with her. Instead, he'd tricked her into trusting him and had lied to her the moment he was able. She felt more foolish than ever. He'd pretended to be her friend, and it was all a lie, wasn't it? No, it wasn't, but we'll get to that. Alice was angry and hurt and heartbroken, and she would stand for this no longer. Her pride wouldn't bear it.
Alice!
Tim again.
No,
Alice finally said, a little angrier than she meant it. I don't know what the law of complex color is. Should I? It didn't sound as awful as everything else I just read.
But it is,
said Tim. His glasses had slid down the bridge of his nose again. He pushed them back up.
It's terrifying, don't you see? They've stripped him of his color.
What?
Alice startled. She felt Oliver flinch.
His color, my dear, his color.
But I don't understand,
she said.
How could they? You should understand better than anyone coming from Fernwood as you do, Tim said. The laws work the same in furthermore. Living off the land gives us our color. It's the magic we consume that makes us bright. Without it, well,
Tim said, gesturing to her face,
I'm sure you know better than anyone the effects of having little magic.
Alice felt she'd been slapped in the face. She'd always known what people thought of her. She'd heard the whispers around town. Fernwood folk had skin and hair and eyes as rich and bright as the land itself. It was the magic in the fruits and plants they ate that gave the people their hue. Being colorful was the mark of being magical, and Alice, having no color, was presumed to have no magic either. And after her recent display at her surrender, Alice was sure she'd finally proven true all their false suspicions. She hung her head in shame. She didn't even try to refute Tim's point.
"So Father looks like me now?"
she said quietly.
"He has no color at all?"
"It's a bit different than that," said Tim. Once an inmate is placed in solitary confinement, he is stripped of all rich color and left only as a grayscale version of himself. He carries not a single bit of brightness, not in his eyes, not in his cheeks. But you, Alice, you exist in full color, not grayscale,
Tim explained.
The bit of brown in your eyes, or maybe the soft pink in your cheeks, these are full and real colors, despite their limited presence. But prisons in furthermore are built only in scales of gray. Currently your father possesses no full color of any kind, which makes him incompatible with the real world. If he tried to go home as he is now, the physical demands of a full color existence would crush him. It's a security measure that makes it impossible for him to escape.
A single sob escaped Alice's lips before she clapped a hand over her mouth. There was such a sudden influx of awful news to contend with that Alice didn't even know where to begin. At least she finally understood why Oliver so desperately needed her. He wanted to solve his task by using her talent, the talent Alice hadn't shared with anyone, the one she should have surrendered and had not, the talent she hated. Oh, she could kill him for it, for lying to her, for deceiving her, for making her think he actually cared about her or Father or any of the pain she'd suffered in Father's absence. Oliver didn't care about her, Alice thought. He cared only about completing his task. Oh, how could she ever trust him again? She couldn't. She wouldn't.
Alice?
It was Tim again. Tim. The only person willing to tell her the whole ugly truth.
Do you understand? Do you now understand why you're so desperately needed?
I do,
she said softly.
But there's still one thing I don't understand.
Yes?
Alice didn't know how to put this delicately.
Why didn't they just eat him?
She asked.
Why put him in prison? Tim was suddenly and visibly uncomfortable.
"Well," he said airily, "you mustn't see us all through the same lens, Miss Queensmeadow.